and Berryville. Cheers.
This week in This American Life, the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln has been in the news lately because of an extra-long deployment that's taken a toll on its crew. So we decided that we were going to replay an old episode showing what that life is really like. You sleep in a room with 196 other people. There are lots of tedious jobs.
Just filling up the vending machines all day for 12 hours.
That's this week.
This American Life, tonight at 6 on Radio Catskill. James Spooner grew up as a punk rocker with a mohawk, but as a mixed-race kid, he didn't always feel like he belonged. Then he found Afropunk.
There was a band called Bushmon. The band was all black. The audience was very black. For the first time, it felt like being black in the punk scene was an asset.
I'm Amory Sievertson. That's on the next On Point.
Monday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
Good morning. Welcome to Catskill Character. I'm Donna Fellenberg, and today is the final show for 2026, commemorating the Woodstock Festival 57 years ago. To acknowledge the 50th anniversary, Jason Dole and I had gone to the memorial at Bethel Woods and spoken to people who were gathered there. In the second half of the show, you'll hear two of those conversations. But in the first half of the show, we have a conversation that took place at Bethel Woods on August 8th with Jason Dole and myself and Rona Elliott. Now, Rona is on the board of the museum at Bethel Woods, but one of her first jobs at the tender age of 22 was as the local public relations liaison for Woodstock Ventures. Yes, she was there at Woodstock from May until September, helping to get the festival off the ground and I guess tidying up afterwards. She is a preservationist of the legacy of Woodstock, and her views of that and contemporary pop culture since 1969 are invaluable. She is, without a doubt, an American music and pop culture icon. Here's Rona Elliott.
After the Miami Pop Festival, many of us, including Chipmunk and lots of Bill Handley, lots of the other people on the crew, were at the Miami Pop Festival in December of 1969. That is not Michael Lang's Miami Pop Festival. After that, I split up with my boyfriend. I was backpacking around the world. I got a telegram in Algeria from Mel Lawrence, who was the director of operations already at Woodstock, saying, come home, festival in upstate New York. So I was either going to go to the Pan-African Cultural Festival, which was Tim Leary and Eldridge Cleaver, or come back to the Catskills. I picked the Catskills. I went to a bungalow colony here when I was 3 months old. I went to camp here, so it just seemed like the right thing to do. I said to Mel, what should I do? He said, tell Michael what you want to do. I arrived in Wallkill in May of 1969. There were 13 of us. They had already hired a PR company in New York called Wartoke, who are fantastic people. So I said I would do the local PR, talk to the radio stations, TV, print. I spoke at the Kiwanis Club. I organized a square dance. So I was on the ground talking to regular people because I had already been doing PR. So I was here in May, and there were 13 of us in Wallkill. We started out in May of 1969 with 13 people. The last day of the festival that sandwiches were delivered, which was the Thursday, Carol Green, who was the cook, delivered 400 sandwiches. For me, Woodstock was this profound social political experience. It was the culmination of birth control, civil rights movement, feminist movement, assassinations, anti-war demonstrations, the draft coming to white guys who were young. And the way we got together then was to get together musically. Michael's original vision was to do something in the country, have music outside, and share it the way he loved to do it. During the course of the time I was here, every obstacle was put in the way to make this impossible. We ran out of food. We ran out of toilets. People couldn't get here. It didn't make any difference. It all happened. The second day of the festival, the press tent I was using was turned into the second LSD kind of freak-out ward, and I went to help organize the operations people and get food drops and blanket drops and stuff like that. And like I believe everyone else on the staff, you did what was required, whether it was dig trenches for toilets or bring hard-boiled eggs in and blankets from the Hadassah, which is where I got them.
You were a child at Woodstock. How did you deal?
I mean, I don't usually talk about this. First of all, my enormously ebullient personality was much more tempered because I knew I was not the expert at the time. I was, you know, I worked in the office. I went out to the community. If you look at Henry Diltz's pictures and Elliot Landy's pictures, Baron Woolman's pictures, there are a lot of guys in jeans without shirts. There was a lot of male energy. There was one woman to every 15 guys on the staff. There were a number of women here, and I was far more low-key than a lot of others. I knew what I was doing. I kept my head down, and I did it. The same as I may have interviewed Mick Jagger 10 times. I don't need a best friend, neither does he. I'm not looking to be his friend. I'm looking to do my job. And all of the women that worked here, everybody was just doing their job, and everybody was just doing their job everywhere. Nobody was, you know, smoking joints and going off to the Diamond Horseshoe. That's really the truth. People were just working, really just working.
I'm sitting here, I'm looking at you, and I see all of the emotion. But I'm wondering, afterwards, you know how when they say actors are on a set movie yes. crew, and then they leave, and it takes them a while to kind of adjust. I'm wondering, how did you adjust after being here and doing this for all that time?
Mel Lawrence and I went up to Arlo Guthrie's house in the Berkshires to decompress. And Arlo had been an old friend for some time, and we had gone to the Big Sur Folk Festival together, and I needed to just like, what just happened? We moved to Woodstock. The pipes froze. We broke up again. I went to Arlo's house in the city and lived with his brother as his roommate, and I thought that my next stop was spirituality in the Bay Area. And I was there for 8 years. I was on the air with NBC. I was an underground radio. I was at KSAN and KMPX. I set up Paul Krasner's office of The Realist, if you remember Paul. I mean, I did all the alternative and all the mainstream stuff. Because for me, the Woodstock experience was one of four or five experiences that I believe defined me, and I recognized it at the time. I saw Bob Dylan plug in 1965. I saw the Beatles in 1966. I saw the Stones in 1965. I worked at Woodstock. It was obvious this is what I was supposed to do, work in cultural but spiritual events that were transformative. Even if I put on my suit and went back to shaving my legs for NBC, I knew that I was secretly a spiritual warrior. Quite quickly, I realized that somebody needed to start to record the experiences of what happened. So by the time the late 70s had arrived, I had already started to do kind of, we didn't even call them oral histories then, but gather information and stories from mostly the staff. So I sort of, for many, many years, was the person who just gathered stories, gathered histories, archived stuff, kept all my stuff archived, never dreaming there would be a place for it, never dreaming this place would exist. Who could dream such a thing? And for me, the existence of the museum at Bethel Woods is that we have captured it here, and we've captured oral histories, and I've personally spoken to philosophers and writers and all kinds of people who were adjacent to the culture and could talk about it then, so that we can put it in its right place and time. And I am literally sitting now and transcribing for their archive 40 years of interviews I've done with many people who are long gone, including Michael, including Joe Cocker. I mean, one after the other who are gone, the guys in Canned Heat. I've been doing that because I was a journalist, so I would sit down and do that and do specials and stuff like that. And the purpose of this place and why it's so important to me now, I just joined the board, is I didn't think there would be some public place. I didn't think UCLA, okay, I'm on the board of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I can give it to them. But Woodstock isn't the most important thing there. Woodstock is the most important thing here. And in 100 years, when I'm dead, somebody can come in and read the oral history of what happened by people who were there.
I want to tell you about someone I just interviewed before we came here. He's one of our own, Glenn Woodell. He was 20 years old from Kansas. He came out here to teach. He had gotten a job at 20. He already had a year of graduate school under his belt. He came out here. He was a little afraid of hippies. He's working for, what was it called, Food for Love. He's hired to hire the people that are going to work at the concessions. And he was scared out of his mind. They didn't have any food because the trucks couldn't get in. All he had was ice cream pops. So these people are descending upon him. He starts throwing the ice cream pops at them, thinking this will keep the herd at bay. Then he found out, they don't mean me any harm. These are loving people. So I thought, what a great legacy for Woodstock to take this kid from Kansas, and he's representative of an idea.
He wasn't the only one. I have interviewed most of the people that are still alive on the crew, and it was as if they had gotten a call to come here. They felt they heard, these were people who had gone to festivals, they heard about it, and they said, I'm going. They didn't know what they'd do. I mean, this is a story I've heard 10 or 20 times. They came because they had to be here, whatever this was. So again, for me, the power of this is what is its legacy. And for me, Woodstock was, generally speaking, about compassion and love and sharing. And a window opened for that period of time where people got to experience your friend from Kansas, other guy from Arizona who just said, I had to get there. And we are so fortunate to have lived it. You're fortunate to hear about it from people who were there. You know, His Holiness the Dalai Lama came here, and compassion is his brief. Compassion is his mandate. I went to see His Holiness probably in 2005 at UCLA, and he said something I will never forget. It so was life-changing. It was a relatively small audience for him, and there were about 500 people. And somebody said, do you ever worry? Without missing a beat, he said, sometimes I worry I might lose compassion for the Chinese. And I thought, that's why he's the Dalai Lama and I'm not. They slaughtered the Tibetans like everybody else slaughters everybody else. But his job is to be compassionate. So he has to remember that they're suffering first, and that's why they're killing people. So for me, you know, what can I say? I'm so happy to have met you today. And to sit here and to get the chance to talk about this and to encourage people in the Catskills in particular to come here and see what's being done here and see what's being done here for kids and the arts programs and the music programs and the histories and the legacy is preserved here. The preservation of it is so critical because in 100 years, no one will know what happened here. No one will be alive other than some, you know, transcript that they read, like, I came from Kansas and I was terrified and everybody was really nice.
I just want to give a big shout out and many thanks to Rona Elliott, one of the original 13 staff members at Woodstock, for her firsthand insights from the festival and many insights beyond that. She went on to become an important music journalist and cultural historian. Rona's Insta is at Rona Elliott. We'll be right back with more Woodstock memories on Radio Catskill.
Hey, theater lovers, Tom Candelli here from Curtain Call. This week on the show, meet two familiar faces from our local theater community whose lives off stage may surprise you. My guests are Lexi McEntee and Thomas Cambridge. Together, we're going to discuss Lexi performing in the upcoming production of DVAA's Thornton Wilder's Our Town and Thomas in River Rep's production of Harold Pinter's Betrayal. That's this Monday night at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
Although the Justice Department has published thousands of pages of the Epstein files, the quest for accountability goes on.
There are huge pages of redactions that involve descriptions of activity by other possible co-conspirators, whether they be powerful men, we don't know because they're all blacked out.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. This afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Catskill Character. I'm your host, Donna Fellenberg. This weekend is the 55th anniversary of Woodstock, oh my God, and we're celebrating. In the first half of the show, we spoke with Rona Elliott, cultural historian and journalist and one of the first staff members at Woodstock. There were 13 of them, and she was one of the 13. Now we're going to hear three different perspectives from people who were either at the festival or live very nearby. Here are Dan Carlson, Nancy, and Dio Santiago. Enjoy.
Check one, two, check one, two. Check.
My name is Dan Carlson, and I live in Fort Worth, Texas, originally from the Hudson Valley, and worked here in 1969 at the festival as a police officer, and it was a outstanding experience.
So, Dan, you've come a long way to come back here.
Yeah, we're here taking a three-week trip, my wife and I, here for a family reunion. Spent a couple days on Cape Cod, and we'll be going back starting next week.
What's your best memory of being here that weekend?
I was with the Dutchess County Sheriff's Office at the time, and we got here with a bus that we had been sent over with, two buses and some motorcycles, actually. The bus ultimately broke down, and we had to be towed in. That was a pretty inglorious way to come into Woodstock. Well, I was a young cop, 2 years as a police officer, so frankly, I had some stereotypes about hippies, and I wasn't expecting, you know, an awful lot of enjoyable time when I was going to be here, but I learned so much. I mean, I thought I knew everything, you know, but I knew nothing as a police officer. I learned so much over these 3 days about dealing with people and the helpfulness of people and the cooperation. Had people, had the kids here not cooperated and helped out the way they did, this would have been catastrophic. The youngsters that were here were just magnificent. And people say, well, the cops did a good job. Yeah, maybe, but the fact that it wasn't a catastrophe, I put full credit to the youngsters that were here.
Now, you're saying youngsters, but I'm looking at you, and I'm thinking you couldn't have been much older than the youngsters.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, exactly. I was 24 years old, so, but I was a military veteran. My wife and I had one child, another one on the way, so, you know, some of the differences between the world that I was part of and what I assumed the world to be of the hippies I was going to be interacting with was in some ways pretty stark. I learned an awful lot about stereotypes and how wrong they can be. Yeah, one in specific I can remember early. There was no movement here in terms of vehicles. If you were here, you remember everything was gridlocked. But I had a little motorcycle that I was moving around, and I was detailed to escort an ambulance out on Route 17B to Monticello. Well, all the traffic was stopped coming in this way, so we wove our way through until we came to a place where everything was jammed up. One car couldn't move, so I was wondering how we're going to handle this. And 20 to 25 hippies, young people, came out, gathered around the car, picked it up, and carried it out and put it in a meadow and allowed the ambulance to get through.
That was my car.
You're probably still looking for it. I think if we go back on 17B, I can find out where it was. I read a comment from somebody that was here that kind of talked about the experience, and I thought it was a lighthearted way. He said, when I went to Woodstock, I had $300 in new camping gear. I came home wearing somebody else's shoes.
That is perfect.
Isn't that something? A lot of what I learned here, I mean, helped as a cop, but it helped as a human being, really, too. And how you interact with people, how you treat people, and as a consequence, how people treat you.
It's been really great talking to you, Dan. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to have a few words. It was a delightful experience, and good luck.
Next up is Nancy, who lived right by the stage down the road, and as a 13-year-old, she watched the stage going up and had her own pre-Woodstock experience. Here she is.
Hi, my name is Nancy. I live in Bethel, and I'm here to talk a little bit about my experience of Woodstock. I was 13, lived about 4 miles away, and during that time, not realizing that my mom was only 43, so it was very exciting for her. It was too. I thought it was really cool. And every day, we would go to Ranch Aiken Farm, which is right up the road here. So my mother would talk to everybody. That is one of my memories, but that was for the entire month where they were building everything, building the stage. Everybody was in White Lake. It was a really great time, and I think anyone who was here, there's a certain feeling you have. It's almost like a spiritual feeling. Like if you weren't here, you don't know. You can imagine but you really don't know. And the word isn't magical. I don't even know what the word is to describe it, but that's why I'm sitting here today, is just to be here, listen to people, you know, and it's fun.
You know, I'm so glad to hear you say that, because it's very hard to explain to people the connection that you feel. I think it's maybe a connection to your youth is part of it, and it's a connection to something where that was so powerful. And you hold that in your heart forever, I think.
There are hippies that have been coming back for 50 years. At Hector's Inn is Hippie Thanksgiving every year on the Thursday before anniversary weekend, and everyone shows up. And it's fun. You see the same people every year coming from all over the country. I think what everybody who comes here, and the old hippies, anybody, you know, there is definitely a spiritual feeling. You know, it's sacred ground.
It is.
It's totally sacred ground. And I'm glad that Bethel Woods did keep this.
I relate to everything that you're saying, totally.
Everybody can appreciate Woodstock and love everything about it, but unless you were here and actually experience that vibe,
it's hard to relate that to someone else. Yeah. Nancy, thank you so much for speaking with us. I really love talking to you.
Oh, absolutely. I enjoyed it myself.
Peace and love.
Peace and love.
So that was Nancy. I still haven't made it to Hector's, Nancy. Maybe next year. Maybe I'll see you there. Next up, we have Dio Santiago, who was at the festival trying to make a buck, yet he too got caught up in the Woodstock spirit.
I am Dio Santiago. I have a studio in Monticello, New York. I'm a coach and a trainer. A friend of mine had a giant truck, and we filled it with fruit, and we brought it because it was, by that time, the food was scarce. There was no food. He wanted to be in the site, but I was working. I'm a working guy. So he came looking for me. The first night that we tried to get in, we only got down to Route 17, just past White Lake. We could not go any further. And then all of a sudden, the guy in front of me pulled into the field, and he put up a sign. He made his own sign right there. It says, parking, $5. And right away, the entire line of cars filled this lot. I don't know how many cars, maybe 500 cars. And I was watching and said to my friend, do you see that? We are not real businessmen. This is what we should have done.
It wasn't even his property, right?
No, he just pulled it. That's American entrepreneurial ideas at work immediately. When you have the freedom to do things like that, you can make money. So that was the problem. We filled it up with the fruit in Liberty. The Liberty, they had a wholesale, fruit wholesale in Liberty. And then we couldn't get in. But I am an old fisherman here in Sullivan County. So I know some of the back roads. So we actually were able to get to Liberty first. Then we came to Jeffersonville. And then from Jeffersonville, I knew that there was a couple of cow paths into the back where the ponds were. And it had been used, and it kept open by the ambulance system because that's the only way they could get in and out. We went right by the ponds, and the naked people there are all full of mud, and that took us right to where the helicopter and the ambulance site was located. And directly across from that, I found a space, so I said to him, pull right in there. But when I got off the truck and I went to the back, it was 500 people right behind it. We opened the gates, and the interesting thing, that all these people, all these young people that were there, everybody had $20 bills. And I didn't have any change. So I just said to them, on that empty box over there, just throw the money and take as much food as you need. We weren't scamming anybody. We were selling everything like two for half a dollar, two for a quarter. And there were apples and pears and all kinds of fruit. About 6 hours later, we ran out of the fruit. That was it. That's the end of the story.
That's how long a truckload of fruit lasted on the early end of Woodstock.
About 6 hours, right. And then we were stuck there because we couldn't get out. We had to stay there. Then we enjoyed the show.
Do you remember any?
And well, yeah, a lot of naked women coming around said, you have anything left? So that's another story.
Looking at the world through the sunset in your eyes. Traveling the train through clear Moroccan skies. Ducks and pigs and chickens call
Animal carpet, wall to wall. American made is 5 foot tall and blue.
The pig farm, I gotta tell this. The pig farm.
The hog farmers?
Yeah, they did a tremendous job at the site. Feeding people. They also treated many of the overdose because the drugs, of course, were just flowing. And the ambulance people could not keep up with them. That was right across from where we were parked. They were overwhelmed. So I got to give a lot of credit to the pig farm. They came all the way from Texas, I believe, New Mexico and Texas, and they built a small village. People didn't see it because it was kind of like in the woods. They built a small village with lights and barbecues.
You were there? You saw the hog farm?
Yeah, we were all there. We were all helping. You know, I donated a big box of plums, as a matter of fact, because a guy with a big Western hat came over, big giant guy, and says, I'm liberating the plums for the pig farm. So I had a big machete sitting on the side of the truck there on the wall, and I looked at it, and I looked at him. I said, it's okay. We're going to be there later, and we're going to donate some, but right now we're doing selling. Later on, when we were running out of the stuff, we took a little break, and I took a case of the plums, and they were feeding people and places where they could lay down and overcome the overdoses. It was an event. It was a human event. And the area here should be proud that we were participants in that. And the fact is that there were no major tragedies. There was no any kind of evil event. Everybody was very happy.
Happy anniversary, Woodstock Nation, and all of the people still here to remember and cherish those incredible 3 days. Many thanks to Bethel Woods for allowing Jason Dole and I to record up at the monument. Thanks as always to Jason and also to Dan, Nancy, and Santiago for 3 very different experiences, yet with similar feelings. If you have a Woodstock story and would like to share it for next year, please send an email to feedback@wjffradio.org or leave a message on the Catskill Character Facebook page. Catskill Character is on every Saturday at 11:30. Please join us then for more fascinating stories from fabulous characters of the Catskills. I'm Donna Fellenberg. Thanks for listening, and I wish you peace, love, and joy.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from King Pizza Records, a New York-based DIY rock and roll label focused on creating community through music. King Pizza is a pizza party for the garage or basement. They serve up fuzz, reverb, and earworm melodies in multiple genres. More information at kingpizzarecords.com and on Bandcamp, Facebook, and Instagram. From generous funding from the Public Media Bridge Fund. And from listeners like you, who donate at wjffradio.org.
On this week's Wait, Wait, Jeopardy! Host Ken Jennings admits he never used to like those short interviews with contestants.
Even as a kid, I would sometimes have to leave the room during a boring story. It's like Jeopardy! Stops for a second and Curb Your Enthusiasm begins.
Yes, right. I'm Peter Sagal. This week, Ken Jennings answers the questions, plus Olivia Munn, EGOT winner Bobby Lopez, and more. Join us for the show without any cringe moments. That's Wait, Wait from NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
Pints for Public Radio is back. Join Radio Catskill tonight from 6 to 10 p.m. at Rose's Bar and Grill in Berryville. With DJs James Friedman, Tommy Castro, and Woody Wood Jr. spinning tunes, it's an evening of brews, beats, and community spirit, with a portion of the proceeds benefiting Radio Catskill. Come out, drink beer, and support public radio. It's just that simple. Pints for Public Radio, tonight at 6 at Rose's Bar and Grill in Berryville. Cheers!
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming online at wjffradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.